Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And you're listening to Start Writing.
So, and this week we have your grammar and poetry episode. I think we ended up pushing this one back, one, because I had the Dave Chesson interview that I wanted to release, and two, we had Thanksgiving, and we did a re-release of a discussion for that week. So here is your grammar and poetry. And so we will be talking about singular they, where it comes from, who's used it, and when you can use it. So, and yeah. So this week in critiques, I came across this line, and I think you guys have probably noticed this, but this week in critiques, usually these are things we've talked about in great depth, and we've just noticed them as we're continuing to read people's writings. So this is the line. The breath was knocked out of her as Drisk was pulled away, screaming, his nails clawing at the ground. And for those of you familiar, this is too many actors, not only in a paragraph, they're both in the same sentence, right?
So it says, was knocked out of her, and then his nails clawing at the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. So the breath was knocked out of her. We end the sentence and the paragraph. And instead of saying as, we just begin a new sentence. Driss was pulled away, screaming, his nails clawing at the ground. And it just cleans up the understanding and the ability of the reader to follow along. And that's what too many actors in a paragraph is all about. One, it allows you to condense your word uses because you're not trying to break up and identify certain characters and speakers with using a lot of words to do that. And two, it just helps the reader track what's going on a lot easier without getting confused about who's doing what and what's happening to who. So that was my This Week in Critiques. And Travis has our writing true.
Okay.
Jay has a writing crew. One day.
Jay Travis. Okay, so one of my favorite books of all time is The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. And I read another book. It was the first time I've read any of his other books, but I read one called A Manuscript Found at Accra. And as I was reading it, I thought, you know what? This feels to me like a rough draft of The Alchemist. And I began to realize the difference between the two books was not, well, so I'll just tell you one thing that I love about The Alchemist is there's like these deep philosophical gems. And so you read it and you get inspired by like these deep truths that he shared. And The Manuscript Found in Accra has that same element. But what it doesn't have is a narrative that kind of makes those truths make sense.
Mm.
And so it just made me realize that the narrative of The Alchemist is not really why I love that book. But without the narrative, I don't think I would love the book.
Huh.
Because it just gives you a platform in order to enjoy and explore these deeper philosophies.
It feels like the workbook I'm writing right now. I guess that kind of feels like all the books I write.
Yeah, so, but it's just a strong narrative is central, even when you have like a high idea book.
Yeah.
And anyway, it was cool to notice that. And I, by the way, if you enjoy The Alchemist, I think you might still enjoy this other book. But it's pretty clear to me why the one is a bestseller and why, I mean, you'll have people like Bill Clinton or Will Smith saying, oh, The Alchemist, you got to read The Alchemist. And they don't say that about this other book, even though in a way right. It's so similar.
So that's funny. I my mom was telling me about some of Dan Brown's books that I haven't read. She said the stuff he wrote before The Da Vinci Code. Mm. And she said he wrote like two or three. She says, and they all feel very much like The Da Vinci Code. And it was like he finally got it to work in that novel. And I feel like it's a similar thing. He wrote this book and he really just kind of went back and rewrote it with a narrative into The Alchemist, just like Dan Brown was essentially rolling the same ideas over and over and finally got a narrative to work. And that was this huge hit.
Yeah. Way huge.
Way huge. Yeah.
So there you have it. Writing true.
Writing true. So, all right. So, as you know, it's a plural pronoun, but it's also used as a general neutral singular pronoun. And we'll talk about why you can use it as a singular. And then, of course, you've got the derivatives. There's them, there, theirs, and them, themselves. I would get that right. So, you know, and so any of these, we're going to talk about why you can use it as a singular and as a gender neutral.
So I think I'll just interrupt right here. I've had teachers tell me not to do this, and then I became a teacher, and I have marked students off for using they as a singular. And my perspective, I'll just say before this episode, is that I try to avoid using this, and I usually feel like there are ways to avoid it. However, you're about to see that it's actually okay to do it.
That's what
we're going to talk about.
So why would you want a gender neutral phrase, right? The singular they and then gender neutral. And so one example is that you don't know the gender of the person, right? So somebody left their umbrella in the office. Would they please collect it? So we will talk about the history of using he here in just a minute, but a few other examples. Because we don't know who left, we don't know their gender, right? Who left the umbrella. And then the reflexive form would then be themselves as opposed to themselves. So this is the one exception when we talked about the derivatives, is when you're using that singular they and you want to use themselves instead of themselves.
Wait, so you might say, would they come identify themselves?
Yes.
And that's singular.
That's singular.
Sort of.
And that I would even consider overly formal, okay, right? Like if you're writing some kind of report or something like that, I wouldn't even use that in fiction writing, because I think it's a stop point for a reader to be like, is that correct? It doesn't feel like it's correct.
So unless your character is a grammar Nazi.
Yeah, a grammando.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, okay. So technically, I think it was in the 1940s or 50s, you had this big rise in feminine, and that's where there was this pushback on he as gender neutral, right? But I think we even have like the writings of George Washington where he himself talks about using he as a gender neutral term, right? If you don't know, you use he.
That's interesting.
And then
why was Washington talking about,
I don't know, it was grammar. Just some letter, I guess he was having a discussion with somebody via correspondence.
Yeah.
But then there are also like French philosophers who talk about it being like, everyone aspires to the masculine. It's stronger and superior. You use he, right? So this is back in the 1800s when that comes up.
Well, and that's still used today in other languages. Take Spanish, for example.
Right.
When you use the masculine pronoun, so you're supposed to be grammatically correct, use the masculine pronoun when you're referring to a group that has a mixture of gender.
Yeah, but are you learning archaic rules? Because if you go to like a hardcore grammando, they'll say, no, you're supposed to use he.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is I think that's like English politically correct.
Right.
But it's not necessarily universal.
Right, yeah.
But yeah.
So, and the reason behind this, I think, is the masculine person answers the general name, which comprehends both male and female. This is what's written in the grammar books. As any person who knows what he says and fish, right? So that's from the grammar book saying why you should use he as your gender neutral, right? And I think in 1850, I mentioned we have British Parliament, right? Words importing masculine gender shall be deemed and taken to include females. The earliest attempt to create these gender neutral pronouns comes from the 1792, when the Scots economist James Anderson advocated for an indeterminate OU. That's OU. Not he, not she, not it, OU. Later, they tried Z, like he, except with a Z.
But
it was never picked up into common use. And here's the reason why, is because for over five centuries, so back in the 1400s, common people were using they as a singular reference to gender unknown and gender neutral, right? So it wasn't being written that way very often, but people were saying it that way. And so that's why all these attempts to saying you're supposed to use he as gender neutral, or u, or z, none of them worked, because there was already a term in use. Mm-hmm. And it had been around for hundreds of years. It's how people were talking. Right? So some people take issue with singular they because it's plural. We're like, it can't be singular. It's plural. To which we point to the word you. Singular and plural, and we all know how it works, right? You're not losing anybody. Now, I'll talk about my own experience. Now, there's a term in the Midwest and the Southern United States called you all, or y'all, as they say it. And when I first heard y'all, I thought that this was a brilliant adaptation of language. They had taken a problematic term, you being both singular and plural, and created a plural version of it. I was like, okay, that clarifies that. You have you, and then you have you all. And then I was talking to a guy from Texas. He says, no, y'all is both. You, singular and plural, is just how we talk. I was like, that's terrible.
You could have... Ruins the advantage, yeah.
yeah. And so the complaint that they should be plural doesn't hold much water because we already do that with you. And as I mentioned, the use of the singular they has been around since the 14th century in conversation. And it's not even really criticized as incorrect until the 19th century. That's the first time people are start saying that's incorrect and you're ignorant for using it that way. But as always, we will go to the great writers and see what they did as a way to prove how language is used. Here we have Jane Austen. Had the doctor been contented to take my dining tables as anybody in their senses would have done. Daniel Defoe. If the part deserve any comment, every considering Christian will make it to themselves as they go. And then we have Shakespeare. There's not a man I meet but doth salute me as if I were their well-acquainted friend. Hmm. So
yeah, those are strong examples.
Yeah, so again, we go to the great writers because they're writing literature that is standing the test of time, which I think gives a much more consistency to grammar than the people writing grammar books. Hmm. Because half the time they're writing prescriptive grammar, not so much how it's used, but they're telling people how I think you should use it. And, you know, a lot of times they come up short. As I heard one teacher of grammar say, she says, when there is a difference between what is formal, what is written, and what is spoken, always bet on the spoken to survive and the others to go away.
Wow.
He says, because the spoken is what feels right. He says, the formal rules of grammar can cause people to stumble and stutter as they read because it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
But the conversational tone does. And the great writers recognize that and adhere to how the language is spoken, not what grammar teachers were saying you should and shouldn't do.
I've seen a related phenomenon, mostly in contemporary books, where they'll use she as the, I guess you could say, universal singular pronoun. Have you seen that in books? I've seen writers that will switch between he and she when they're talking about just whoever.
Right.
But then I've seen other ones that always stick with she. And it almost seems like kind of like recompense
a feminist push there.
Yeah. But I mean, these are male writers. A lot of females also use that, which I think is great. But so, it's just kind of an interesting.
So, yeah. And then... finally, we have in 2005, they was the word of the year. Singular they was the word of the year, according to the American Dialect Society. So I think particularly with the transgender, the whole movement there, I think that that really was a big push for singular they, because then you could, when you didn't know how someone wanted to be referred to, you had a word already in common use that you could use instead of trying to push Z or ooh, you know, all these
That's
other words.
So great.
So, but yeah. And so, you know, I know a lot of teachers who probably would correct a singular they, saying like, that's incorrect.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say, go ahead and do it. Great writers have done it. And again, they do it because it's a stumbling block for too many readers to push these hard grammar rules. And these are grammar rules that will probably die more and more as we go forward, because the spoken language is what survives always. And when you go with that spoken language, yeah, a grammando may try and correct you, but a reader won't stumble on the line.
Yeah. Man, so if you're in the English class and you have a teacher busting your chops over this. You just pull up some Shakespeare.
Pull up some Shakespeare. Look, singular they, man. Look at that. Hundreds of years ago.
Or Jane Austen.
Yeah, Jane Austen.
She'll convince them. She'll convince them.
She'll convince them.
Yeah. A single teacher.
A single teacher. There you go. All right. Well, thanks for listening. It's a grammar episode, so they're pretty short, as you guys know. We would love it if you would leave a review, recommend us to your writing friends so they can check us out as well. We do condense the show into a couple highlights that we release on Twitter. That's at @JBENDOSKI or at...
At JWashburn3.
Yep. too many J Washburns out there. So you can follow us on Twitter if you just want some quick highlights, some reminders of the show that way. And if you want to support us, as always, we would love it if you would pick up one of our books. That is the end of our episode, so it's time to start writing.
Okay. I know we've done several of these grammar and poetry episode releases without poetry, and part of that was I have been negotiating the copyright law surrounding poetry. Originally, I wanted to do some fairly original poems that people were unfamiliar with, but as I've encountered the copyright laws surrounding them and working to get permission, it's been taking 2-3 months to get permission approved for a single poem, and it was just a little bit too much legwork trying to get through all of that to be able to access these poetry. So we're going to be going with poems that are in the public domain so that I don't have to deal with any of the copyright laws, which means that these are going to be probably classics, they're going to be older poems and whatnot. Until I can maybe get a hold of some poets directly who own the rights to their own poetry, without having to deal with any kind of publishers in between. So this is from W.B. Yeats, Never Give All the Heart. Never give all the heart for love. Will hardly seem worth thinking of to passionate women if it seem certain and they never dream that if that it fades out from kiss to kiss. For everything that's lovely is but a brief, dreamy, kind delight. Oh, never give the heart outright, for they, for all smooth lips can say, have given their hearts up to the play. And who could play it well enough, if deaf and dumb and blind with love? He that made this knows all the cost, for he gave all his heart and lost. That's Never Give All the Heart by W.B. Yeats. And that is the end of the grammar and poetry episode. So as always, we would love it if you'd check out one of our books or let some of your writer friends know about our podcast.